that it would be untrue. You know that I would be a liar if I was to say to you, girl, we couldn't get much higher. Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Try to set the night on fire. The time to hesitate is through. No time to wallow in the mire. Try, now we can hold it. And I will become a fuel fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Try to set the night on fire. Disappear just like the lesbians in Queers. No one can drop without the grace of someone's silent face. And you can take that by blacks who really hurts you. But sadly, when your soul builds even higher, you'll be right to die to die with the bad on the streets. If I computers only suits and the world made this drive change. Thank you.
had something that he needed, and he dreamed with birthdays don't go. On the day that she left, he died, but it did not show. He says he only lives for beer, but deep in his heart is a crying fear. Give me a heart to hang on to, give me a sword's tale to do, give me a heart to hang on to. A heart to hang on to. Oh, Sally seems to get bigger every day. She evens out in a contented way. A finger on the pulse of every guy, but deep in the night you can hear her cry. Give me a heart to hang on to, give me a suit that's tailored true, give me a heart to hang on to.
So this is meeting number 117.
Good number.
Yeah. Better than
that. We have a smaller, tighter group here, though interestingly we have disembodied attendees floating around us who will embody in their words
there goes
and images.
One right now. Exactly. Right out through the air conditioner.
Right out through. Yeah.
That's what I was talking about, things moving around.
Start closely, nearly, with the recurring dream of electronic cage, extending into the night, through blankets, its stress, what Quinn culture's works to compel, but even to waking dreams. It is mine, but maybe not mine alone. The pressure to work daily, like there aren't clowns commanding nations and armies, and more pressing for a go. And the newspapers long dulled even of the years-long bloodshed across the globe, rather to headline the errant shake of a cock. And the question may best be said thus. who would seriously regard any of these institutions if they did not hold the guns? So I wonder, in these days passing from spring to summer, there are far more words counseling a sense of diminished prospects, of hunkering down for long times of want to come. It's as though the powers that be have decided that there's best profit to be gotten in the general atmosphere of paucity, its fear of worse to come, its skepticism of hopeful voices or new ideas. I wonder, can this be possible, to convince otherwise thriving parts of the world that these are times of recession, even depression, that good governance means there is less to spread around, to share, certainly less time and fewer resources to devote to retarding human suffering and global environmental destruction. Now is a time for a reinforced military and ever more fortified minority of wealthy individuals and families. Say it. These are hard times. Say again. These are hard times. It gets easier. Hard times. More expensive resources. Suddenly rarer. Hard times. Less innovation for alternative innovation. Hard times. A push toward religious fundamentalism. Return to values of some other time. Hard times. No times for the rights of the vulnerable, the different, the old, the sick. Hard times. Yet some go on making the kind of money necessary to erode the laws that prevent them from making even more money while enforcing an atmosphere of scarcity and suffering that most of the world's population must endure. Simply ask who profits by whose suffering, and are they sufficiently in ownership of the governments, the armies, and the mass media necessary to portray these times as hard ones? I don't think the answers will ever show nakedly clear, because the rot is embedded in the institutionalized systems of powers themselves. Empires consume themselves, lastly. The difficult thing to see that what exists now is not the Roman Empire or British Empire, but the empire of men. Power over the planet and the lives of billions that it can no longer be parsed out to identify a king or a nation. There is no longer a pretense of opposing philosophies of governance. There is simply jostling for greater pieces of the pie. So what then? If a pseudo-democratic world empire of guns and resources exists, if the differences among nations and within nations among political parties is a ruse, a spangled lie, what then? Some will counsel slumbering with dreams of last days. The world will burn or pass away, or its promised savior will return in glory and lights. Or the aliens will land. Something. Dreams and cries of the helpless, the very slowly drowning. So here's what I've got. I say no, tonight, here on, to my dreams of the electronic cage. I say no because no is a place to start. It's what I've got to hand. It's my stone to throw in this prison of glass, willing to show the plentiful, brilliant, miraculous world, but then turn faces away and say no, it's not so much there anymore. There's less of it for us. Look down, look down. Yes, the world is what to dream of, its riches, its goodness, but look down, look down. Say no. It's simple. It's hard. It's tiring. What reward? Sometimes little, almost none. But something. Maybe the bones must harden again. Say no. Here. Then push. Back off. But again, no. No. Something gives way. A bit. A convulse. A crack. Not often. Not for long. But see it. It is a very real empire, worldwide, and yet the power of no. Again. Again. Thrown stone in the prison of glass, the free air before the pain is patched. Say no until you are ready to say yes. It will come too, in as many ways as many thousand little ways. Nor will it supplant the will and wish to say no. The fully conscious human animal will choose to say one or the other or neither, making the choice in all, saying with and against others each and every time, thinking, choosing, speaking each and every time. Feel that shake? That convulse? It's the sound of this very real and quite illusory empire shaking a little, wondering how much you know, how long you can hold out, how many others.
What people keep retreating, and you'll never fall in love when everybody keeps retreating, and you can't sit together. Let my love open the door. I am all a key to your heart. I can stop you from falling apart. God, do not find this way. I want to give you a chance to say that God will open the door. It's all I'm living for. Release yourself from misery. There's only one thing that will set you free. That's my
entitled She's Like a Rainbow, the poem.
She's like a rainbow.
That's all I had to say. You
got
it immediately.
Is her hair. Yeah. Sorry, I couldn't.
No, remember. That's it. I was inspired by hearing that on the radio one day. And it just,
songs,
yeah. Got me thinking about rainbows and she's like rainbow. What does that mean if she's actually like a rainbow? If she had somehow all six colors of the rainbow whined about her being very sweet. So it was a little
spectrum.
Yeah, yeah, so yeah, full spectrum lover. Yeah.
Well, I mean, we're tasting colors.
Yeah.
So
anyhow, so that's what inspired me. So, so I incorporate the various colors here. So she's like a rainbow. Red is your tongue, and it flickers in my mouth. A joyful bird, a restless snake, an electric quiver. Feel how we glide, vessels of flesh and weightlessness. Hard your clasp, your grasp, your fire. Fires of joy, joy of fusion. We emerge peaceful, bold, tasted. The leaves were orange and shaped like questions, so I asked you to fling your unknowns before me. I asked you to show me the risks and rewards. Or the leaves were questions and shaped like oranges, I really couldn't say. I was beside myself, sitting beside you for the very first time. Every day the sun, every day your intelligence, a lovely old star and a lovely old soul, both easy to honor and a blessing to fathom. Your insight is solar, concise, why not yellow, with the same shining power and grace to pick harmony over strife. How many springtimes have you marveled at green? How many more shades do you gather today? Out in the pond, your creaturely eyes scan pine tops for herons, log ends for turtles. Closer to the season, deeper into your green. Closer to the season, deeper into green. Eternity enters your bloodstream. You're my deep blue anchor, not blue as sad, but as alchemic bond and paradox, an anchor without chains, connecting me to the man I am becoming with you. Exotic internal indigo, your private girl language, it floats to the pebbled ceiling to pop on a seahorse chandelier. You trust me with it all, our horizons reinvent. Your face freshens and soars under violet light, warmth and wonder pool in your gaze. You attend the world without guile, downward-facing dog, upward-facing goddess. Purple's your field and your aura, your way of being, your invitation to warriors and doves.
Excellent. Colors are great.
Yeah.
A collection from Harper's Magazine about New England. The one that I picked out is from 1899. It's Boston at the Century's Inn.
I was just
going to read the opening part of it, but it's very long. It's very tiny font, too. A peculiar circumstance accentuates the landscape at a certain point on the New England coast. The mountains and the sea there part company. This happens for the traveler southward bound along the continent shore. Having passed in succession the heights of Mount Desert and camped in with feet in the salt waves, the grand tumultuous masses of the White Mountains rising far inland, and the lone peak of Agamenticus. Finally, from the Cape Ann headlands, there appears to the southwestward a billowy blue range across the white waters. Though their greatest elevation lacks the 1,000 by a foot for each of the year's days, these heights have all the character and dignity of true mountains, and they are the last outposts of the continent's titanic rock ribs that may greet the eye along all the rest of the eastern coast of our great republic. These hills have a truly alpine history, for geology says that they were once many thousands of feet high and perpetually snow-crowned. In political history, too, they have played an alpine part, for they gave their name to Massachusetts Bay and its famous colony, cradle of modern democracy. Massachusetts meant the place of the great hills, the Indians explained, but having imparted their name, the hills resigned it to the waters and the nascent commonwealth, and thenceforth were called the Blue Hills of Milton. Nature stamped the landscape at the head of Massachusetts Bay, where one of the world's renowned cities grew up, with the gracious individuality of the mid-New England seaboard in its most pleasing aspects. The region, with its mountain landmark, was geographically a point of departure, and politically it became a point of arrival. In natural scenery, it was a sort of meeting place, an assemblage of divers, very attractive elements. The rocks and the glacial debris, the meadows and the marshes, the sparkling streams and the placid lakes, the bays and the meandering inlets, the crescent beaches and the rough headlands pounded by the surging sea all combined to produce delightful scenery of well-nigh kaleidoscopic variety. When the great navigator John Smith sailed into the island-studded expanse now known as Boston Bay, there spread indefinitely before him what seemed to be a most royal river with vast inland-reaching potencies, and in honor of England's future king, the splendid seeming stream was named the Charles. But less than a score of miles from the Narrows, the fresh waters of three rivers of only moderate size poured into their salty estuaries, and nothing further was seen of the expected great river. These three rivers broke through the barrier of the wild rock hills that encircle the Boston Basin and made leisurely way to the sea, meandering around gracefully modeled drumlins that give peculiar characters to the landscape. Hills of glacial drift and gently rounded waveforms contrasting markedly with the rugged rocky heights nearby. In shape like a half watermelon cut lengthwise, these hills rose first from the meadows of river valleys, then from the far-spreading salt marshes, and lastly from the salt waters direct in peninsulas and islands about and within the bay. Here and there, there were also promontories jutting out as if in final reminder of the mountains. Much of this was changed as time went on, but it is important to note the physical environment, whose features did much to shape the great city which has spread all around this bay, whose many liquid fingers reach up through the varied landscape. Had this urban growth been a conscious one, had such a momentous future been suspected, the process would naturally have adapted itself to topographical requirements, and many enormous costs might have been avoided. We are told that the rambling streets of the towns that clustered on the slopes of the Drumlin Peninsulas, islands moored to the main only by slender necks of land, were largely engineered by cows. We know how the chief of these Drumlin half-islands, Shawmut, was called Tremont and Trismountain for a while before it became Boston, the metropolis of North America, as the maps of the 18th century had it. Though that rank passed to Philadelphia and thence to New York, the steady growth of the port kept on. But the town meeting served the community's purposes in self-government almost to the end of the present century's first quarter. It is worth remembering that in the period of Boston's first corporate cityhood, in the third decade of the 19th century, when Salem and Nantucket ranked next in importance among Massachusetts towns, the United States was a land of rural communities, and the greatest city of North America was not on the continent at all. It was Havana on the island of Cuba.
The old rowboat collects everything as it rides through the dead world, collects what crawls from the black water, what falls from vines overhead, what is sometimes thrown from shore by unseen hands or paws, even fins. The water is smooth, calm like death, mirrors the dark sky where nothing shines by day and nobody looks up to see at night. You're wondering how I know, from where I see this boat. He told me about it, my brother, who won't sleep to see it better. The back room is his whole quiet world, where he shuns food, bed, radio, TV, to see it better, to use his every sense to see, use his tingling, saggy skin, lays on the floor in a cluster of pained limbs, fights through visions, streets of skulls, shoreless ponds, children too. I don't know if he knows me when I come, shut the crooked door, kneel close to him, see and smell and taste his sickness, sample his current hour's picture, decide to stay or no. He talks of the burnt umber tentacle, reaching back, the dragging pink wing feathering the water, the seagull's heart, a decaying stone in the chipped blue shell. Sometimes the boat is moving slower, he croons, and I almost touch him. Refrain, remember another time. It was bad. Walking back into the shop, where the patrons beg for books of easy treatises on God and cartoons of lovers from their hearts' forbidden chambers, I stop. I wonder again if this is my brother's boat, if his onion-shaped bullets and wooden bells leaking fuel oil aren't this world, a level or two below, moving ever slower. Okay, this next poem, I'm going to skip a few, is called White Tuxedo and Black Top Hat. The dice roll six and I look out the long window. My father laughs, knowing things I do not. Better answers, no answers, I can't say. I turn back to him, to the others, to the gas pump I can't figure to operate. My father nods and we each take turns. This apartment will need everyone's help to make a good go. Sophia, I love her name most of all. She calls it a cat's name and says no more, smiling. She picked out the furniture, all of it. Blonde woods, old, needing work, hands-on, love. She found curtains in thrift shops and sewed them back together. Eventually, I have to go. Parties like these come to their dreaming end with the dawn, that chilly morning breeze. I look at my father. Give me something before I go. Go on, fucker. Give it me. Now he's not smiling. Stop singing from your knees. I nod, because what else would a dream worth recalling have to say? Number 22, called Another Way, is a poem I had about Jim. Oh, the glass foam, yeah.
Catch up.
Yeah. So this is a dream I had, you and I, and it's pretty much a more or less a telling of it in poetical form. I tweaked it a little bit, but it was a very interesting dream. We stood, my brother and me, regarding the pattern on the wall, the labyrinth fading right to left, how to travel that one. I noticed his fingers tapping the tune, the one in my mind too, and a few steps more to daylight, if not answers, numberless paths, if not a way, and the next day's chance. We nodded, went, maybe the fading labyrinth our clue that letting go the map is hard best chance.
I read that.
I sent that to you, right?
I sent that to
you. Yeah.
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 And that's still the end of it, right? Letting go is the hard best chance.
Anyway, okay, up to 24. This is called Winter Island, and it is from responding in part to our Cassie and I took a trip to Salem recently.
Salem, Mass.
The preacher stood outside among his stars, arms held out to his God's lights. Open, waiting, smiling, waiting, and nothing. Minutes, the hours passed, he returned inside, his immaculate rooms, his plain narrow bed, closed the drapes. Walked the rooms wordless, still listening, still out there among those lights, so close, waiting. In his study, its walls ceiling to floor in books, there in the corner, three small dead rats. And look, out the door, races a cockroach, shiny shell, see it go. Walked outside again, now shedding clothes, mile by mile, to the far end of the island, the lighthouse, the rocks below, evening seas thick with fog, arms out again, far out. No why, and there never was. How beautiful. His God had not descended, neither taken him away, explained nothing, remained. Oh my. Anyway, the next poem is called Decision Tree, which is oddly a... It's a phrase that is part of my daily job now. A decision tree is a technical thingamabob that I work with every day. But I decided I liked it as a phrase.
I like that too.
You know, because you never would know that this is a computer term.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a very deep dream poem. This is not ripped from the headlines like the last one. Extracting the poison from its mash, we converting it to the honey drink we dreamed, smiling and mindless its tasters, and soon the end of this world. We'd go into classrooms, meet families in their homes. It would take a while. Yes, they found me, though my love remains free. They'll burn me and bury me miles in the earth tonight, as though flames and shovels may undo. My love knows better, watching those who drink the honey, smiling and mindless they leave this world, melt clean through, the hardest human idea clawed in the stream. My love knows you will drink this honey and let it go at last, whatever it is, and as you do, and as it goes, your senses will new wild to the sunshine, sounds of water on metal, the smells of those blooms as you go, and the happy, happy dust. Okay, here's another poem. Pretty hardcore. I mean, this is a image from a dream, among other things. It's called Blood Canvases. An old small figure hurries through street lamps and hard pour, bent spine like the question bodies form young, and minds keep asking until old. Keeping along with this figure, step into a lit shop and the jingling jostle of others, the question on the shelves of goods, answers on the labels, among the pages, answers in long rows of auditioning come hither carnies, and which to choose, or select a few and mix up a stew. Back in the rain, no less hard, hurry, the figure is diminishing with a sack and the strong wish to be alone. Into the building, the many steps, the tilted door of home, ah, sounds of deadbolt and latch. Now open the sack, take out the answer, only one was taken, and lay aside the question, chipped from spine, just to see. Consider, yes, yes, turn off the lights, try candles, some music, there, that old song of skeletons in moonlight, there, yes, will do. Anyway, this is called Kindness Mows Binds. I learned a lot that summer living in the drainage ditch by the sidewalk. At first, people just stared at me, unable to parse out my angle or shill. Eventually, they made picnics nearby, not too near, but enough to call me a neighbor. The mayor appeared, a man in a waxen suit and linen mustache. Several bigger men flanked him, looking for my bigger men, studied the security details of my ditch, frowned. The mayor, I think it was him, I'd like to think it was him, smiled, urged an alliance, gestured around where we lay together, all these picnickers. By summer's end, even the older dogs and butterflies were going or gone. I felt ready to stand up, move along. It had been a good run. The brown grass beneath me would green again, it always does. The molded form of my body would remain, oh, a while, and then it too would go where everything goes when gone, but not forgotten. Okay, and finally, it's called Seeding, and it begins with a line from Bill Hicks, the comedian. Are you familiar with him, Joe?
Yeah. Sounds.
Yeah. There's a rant he gives in which he basically says life is just a ride, and he talks about being it's just a ride. So that's what I went with as a kind of an inspiration. What if you realize one day that everything is alive? Not one, as many, the guru would say, still many, but alive. All alive. The easy of this watching your love stirring the dawn, walking the pathless trees of an unnamed wood. The hard of this when looking at the worn-out things of men, lost of shine and purpose, gummed and greasy, broken last hour or longer. Mapless, you follow this thought, you make along as before, step high among the daily prejudice and bored laughter, but now uneasy with your own movements. Do these live things know and accept their ends, the jar of vegetable paste, even the half-crushed moth on the sidewalk? Is the first glad its contents now spent out? Does tossing the other from sidewalk to bush wreck its passage? The questions are ridiculous, remain, widened to include paperclips and tree branches, parts severed by the night's thunderstorm. Where does thought and feeling end? How to know? Are the usual borders even most useful? This electing of men, getting of coin, washing every new soul in a half-reverence of the world, yet still the numbers measure decay by the years, still the promise rusts pretty by. Some say dispose things better. Some burn it all. Some include us too. The world little worth a sober god's remaining glance and cleansing stroke. Such a loathing that the dead are boxed well and imagined free to sing unsheathed of mouth and bones. Some say there are answers to this world, every fallen icon and twisted bone in the red dust. But later, love, later along the tale. But say, everything is alive. made to find its function and receive its due. Aren't the massing murderous ways of men enough? Why worry the dark light bulbs and steers to the knife, the fate of snowflakes and old wrecks and deserts and rivers? Do some empathies lead nowhere but lonesome dream corners of the fancy? I've surely wondered all this, as you do tonight, felt the chasm among each and all, wide and bricked as though by stone. I've wondered, too, why feel but only so far? Why imagine but with an eye on the clock, an ear for the door? Tonight, perhaps, we ask this question over a distance wider than the world. Wonder, hopeless, yet still, does paradise not steam from the shit as the sonnet, the burning, the breathless, as every new sound of smoke?
They say that love often passes in a second. You can never catch it all. So I'm hanging to you as though eternity beckons. But it's clear that the match is wrong. I am so sure, tell me not to try and continue. I thought I'd ask you a piece of the plan I do. So keep an eye open, my spirit is broken. Your love's so incredible, your body's so edible. You give me an overdose of love. But just a little is enough. Just like a sailor hanging into the sea, there's a gale blowing in my face. My eye would scare me, but I need the breeze. And I can't head for any other place. Life would seem so easy on the architect, but even a hurricane won't turn me back. A sky sets me reeling, a kiss feels like stealing. Your love is like heroin, this hand keeps going. I can't pretend that I'm bummed. It's a little dizzy now.
She wants her man.
ride my GS scooter with my head on me, or with my warthog hole in the wind sleeve. I see her dance across the ballroom. UV lights make it start shine of a smile. I am the face she has to know me. I'm dressed up better than anyone within a mile. Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. So how come the other people suit so much better with all the penny to spare? They dress to the letter. Yet how come the girls come out all so cool? Yet when you meet them, they're all a bunch of fools. Come sleep on the beach, keep within my reach. I just wanna die with you, dear. I'm feeling so warm when you're here. I'm winning a cold, but thank God I am cold. Why didn't I say what I need? I should have played home at 15. There's a story that the grass is so green. I know I should fight, but my old man is really alright, and I'm still living at home, even though it won't last.
15 sexually knowing. The ushers are sniffing, holding cologne. The seats are seductive, celebrating. Pretty girls, digging, pretty and wounded. Magically bored, on quiet street corner. Free frustration, can I high heel with toes? I am stormwater, my generation. Uppers and downers, in the way my flows. Out of my brain, on the train. Strapping, born in a war, birthday punching, human drag in a glittering ballroom, greatly outrageous in my high-heeled shoes, tightly undone, know what they're showing, sadly aesthetic, that the hero.
That's all right. You'll have a part two.
Plus, my voice is always a little
man.
Concern of mine. But.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you. I'm glad you liked it.
There'll be one more of mine.
Yeah. I was thinking when we come back, we'll do some cover songs, as it were.
So, this is a poem that is an older poem that I recently butchered and came out with. A new poem.
Yeah, I butcher songs, you butcher poems.
Yeah. No, just there was something that always didn't ring so smooth to me. And I don't, you know, but I just made some changes. So.
Right.
And the reason I even thought of doing that was it was recently the summer solstice.
Oh, that's right.
And
yeah,
I was thinking about that. Didn't
that,
I write a poem about
that?
Summer
he
solstice?
He did.
And this is it.
Is it called that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I remember that title.
That's the 21st, right?
21st. Yeah.
That's my daughter's birthday.
Okay.
Belinda was born during the full moon in 1986 on the summer solstice.
Wow.
I know. Well,
Wicker alert.
I know. Good genes, though. Wicker alert. I know. She used to be a... she was... Daddy, Wicker is not a witch. And I went, okay, I believe it. Just don't want to see any voodoo signs or tattoos on your body or anything. Mm-hmm. Crosses, you know, no crosses.
Screams, exorcism.
Uh-oh.
All right, so it's that poem. Mm-hmm. But I made some changes, so maybe you recognize it. I don't know if you not heard it. Anyhow, summer solstice. Son, we could never have gotten this far without you, and you'll be up most the night, granting but a fillip of darkness to songbirds and insomniacs. Barely 4 in the morning, yet the insistent whistle of a robin pours through screened windows into the sleeper's ears as they reach for their dreams, their glasses, their reflection in the mirror. It's the longest day of a quickening life. Perhaps best to get out early to walk the avenues and paths for a deeper slant of light. And it's on the roofs of the buildings, in the tips of our fingers, on the throats of the songbirds, in the minds of the dreamers, the deep indulgence of a working star, highest and closest to home.
You're up, Cass.
Okay. Well, I think last time I read from the Graveyard book by Neil Gaiman.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I finished it, and at the end of the book, they have his acceptance speech from the Newbery Medal Award. And I'm not going to read most of it, but there are little bits of it that I thought were very interesting. I thought I would read a little bit of it. So, I'm writing this speech 2 months before I will deliver it. My father died about a month ago. It was a surprise. He was in good health, happy, fitter than I am, and his heart ruptured without warning. So, numb and heartsick, I crossed the Atlantic, gave my eulogies, was told by relations I had not seen in a decade just how much I resembled my father, and did what had to be done, and I never cried. It was not that I didn't want to cry. It was more that it seemed there was never any time in the maelstrom of events to just stop and touch the grief to let whatever was inside me escape. That never happened. Yesterday morning, a friend sent me a script to read. It was a story of somebody's lifetime, a fictional person. 3/4 of the way through the script, the fictional character's fictional wife died, and I sat on the sofa and cried like an adult, huge wrenching sobs, my face running with tears. All the unwept tears from my father came out, leaving me exhausted, and like the world after a storm, cleansed and ready to begin anew. I'm telling you this because it's something that I forget and need to be reminded of, and this was a sharp and salutary reminder. I've been writing now for 1/4 of a century. When people tell me that my stories help them through the death of a loved one, a child, perhaps, or a parent, or help them cope with a disease or a personal tragedy, or when they tell me that my tales made them become readers or gave them a career, when they show me images or words from my books tattooed on their skin as monuments or memorials to moments that were so important to them they needed to take them with them everywhere, when these things have happened as they have over and over, my tendency is to be polite and grateful, but ultimately to dismiss them as irrelevant. I did not write the stories to get people through the hard places and the difficult times. I didn't write them to make readers of non-readers. I wrote them because I was interested in the stories, because there was a maggot in my head, a small squirming idea I needed to pin to the paper and inspect, in order to find out what I thought and felt about it. I wrote them because I wanted to find out what happened next to people I had made up. I wrote them to feed my family. So I felt almost dishonorable accepting people's thanks. I had forgotten what fiction was to me as a boy, forgotten what it was like in the library. He talked early about growing up in libraries and being like a feral child living in the libraries. Fiction was an escape from the intolerable, a doorway into impossibly hospitable worlds where things had rules and could be understood. Stories had been a way of learning about life without experiencing it, or perhaps of experiencing it, as an 18th century poisoner dealt with poisons, taking them in tiny doses such that the poisoner could cope with ingesting things that would kill someone who was not inured to them. Sometimes fiction is a way of coping with the poison of the world in a way that lets us survive it. And I remembered, I would not be the person I am without the authors who made me what I am. The special ones, the wise ones, sometimes just the ones who got there first. It's not irrelevant, those moments of connection, those places where fiction saves your life. It's the most important thing there is. So then he concludes the speech. In a speech, you are meant to say what you are going to say and then say it, and then sum up what you have said. I don't know what I actually said tonight. I know what I meant to say, though. Reading is important. Books are important. Librarians are important. Also, libraries are not child care facilities, but sometimes feral children raise themselves among the stacks. It is a glorious and unlikely thing to be cool to your children. His kids now think he's cool for winning the Newbery Award. Children's fiction is the most important fiction of all. There, we who make stories know that we tell lies for a living, but they are good lies that say true things, and we owe it to our readers to build them as best we can, because somewhere out there is a someone who needs that story, someone who will grow up with a different landscape, who without that story would be a different person, and who with that story may have hope or wisdom or kindness or comfort, and that is why we write.
Thank you.
You've not yet met our friend David Hartley, the guy from New Jersey.
This is true. I've never met Mr. Hartley.
But there's possibilities. He's living down in Maryland now, but there's possibilities that Rick and I have been helping to engineer that he and his roommate might at some point move up back up to Boston.
Huh, really?
So there might be a chance for you to get to meet him. He's a really good guy. Very smart.
What's the impetus for the move?
Well, I mean, he's like, he lived here many years and then he left. And so he's thinking about returning.
To Maryland. Oh, he just wants to move back.
I think his mother's down there, right?
That was the reason he left.
So anyway, I asked David, on the phone yesterday. I was calling all my disincarnate friends to get, you know.
Yes, disincarnate friends.
Yeah.
Wait, did we just decide one way or the other?
Oh, well, let's do this one more run, then we'll do juice. Yeah. I said to David, what would you like me to read on your behalf? And he said he's been reading Sigmund Freud lately, Civilization and Its Discontents, which I think was Freud's last work. And I went to Wikipedia and I found a little description of the book, so we have a little setup for what it's about, and then I found some quotations from it, which will give us a little flavor of what he's been reading. In this seminal book, Sigmund Freud propounds his perspective by enumerating what he sees as the fundamental tensions between civilization and the individual. The primary friction, he asserts, stems from the individual's quest for instinctual freedom and civilization's contrary demand for conformity and instinctual repression. Many of humankind's primitive instincts, for example, the desire to kill and the insatiable craving for sexual gratification, are clearly harmful to the well-being of a human community. As a result, civilization creates laws that prohibit killing, rape, and adultery, and it implements severe punishments if such rules are broken. This process, as argues Freud, is an inherent quality of civilization that instills perpetual feelings of discontent in its citizens. Freud's theory is based on the notion that humans have certain characteristic instincts that are immutable. Most notably are the desires for sex and the predisposition to violent aggression toward authoritative figures and toward sexual competitors, which both obstruct the gratification of a person's instincts. Human beings are governed by the pleasure principle, and the pleasure principle is satisfied by the instincts. So that's the description of the book, according to the Wikipedia. And here's some quotations. This is food for thought. This is some interesting stuff. So maybe this is a conversation starter. Admittedly an unusual state, but not one that can be stigmatized as pathological. At the height of being in love, the boundary between ego and object threatens to melt away. Against all evidence of his senses, a man who is in love declares that I and you are one, and is prepared to behave as if it were a fact. Civilization, here's another one. Civilization, therefore, obtains mastery over the individual's dangerous desire for aggression by weakening and disarming it, and by setting up an agency within him to watch over it, like a garrison in a conquered city. One feels inclined to say that the intention that man should be happy is not included in the plan of the creation. Happiness, in the reduced sense in which we recognize it as possible, is a problem of the economics of the individual's libido. The question of the purpose of human life has been raised countless times. It has never received a satisfactory answer, and perhaps does not admit of one. Readiness for a universal love of mankind and the world represents the highest standpoint which man can reach. Even at this early stage of the discussion, I should like to bring forward my two main objections to this view. A love that does not discriminate seems to me to forfeit a part of its own value by doing an injustice to its object, and secondly, not all men are worthy of love. Man has become, so to speak, a god with artificial limbs. Human life, in common, is only made possible when a majority comes together which is stronger than any separate individual, and which remains united against all separate individuals. The power of this community is then set up as right in opposition to the power of the individual, which is condemned as brute force. And finally, the fateful question for the human species seems to me to be whether and to what extent their cultural development will succeed in mastering the disturbance of their communal life by the human instinct of aggression and self-destruction. It may be that, in this respect, precisely the present time deserves a special interest. Men have gained control over the forces of nature to such an extent that with their help they would have no difficulty in exterminating one another to the last man. They know this, and hence comes a large part of their current unrest, their unhappiness, and their mood of anxiety. And now it is to be expected that the other of the two heavenly powers, eternal Eros, will make an effort to assert himself in the struggle with his equally immortal adversary. But who can foresee with what success and with what result? It's cheerful stuff.
Well,
what do you think? Any thoughts?
Well, one thought, I don't agree with him on lots of points.
Let it go.
My major objection is he posits that we're aggressive by nature, and I don't believe that.
That our instinctual, what he's saying is that our instincts will
left to our own, we destroy each other.
Well, yeah, but I mean, going back in the essay, the letter, we say one of the comments was our instincts will overcome anybody threatening to us. Our instincts will do that through violence.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that's inherently not true. That I think that our instincts can be controlled.
Mm-hmm.
My instinct, I mean, I've had, what's that famous politician? Was it Jimmy Carter who once says, "I have lusted after woman," or something?
In my heart.
In my heart, I've lusted. But, and I think women do the same thing. Not always. I'm just saying, generally, the population, I could do it. A woman could do it. But the instincts are always controlled. I don't agree with that at all.
He seems to be saying it's a basic drive.
Yeah,
sexual,
right, the basic drive.
Sexual appetite and aggression.
And you don't have to economize your libido. But you can. I'm sorry, maybe I missed the point there, but I don't see that being. If it wasn't, we would have a very archaic world in general. I mean, I know you might argue we do.
We'd be Klingons.
We'd be Klingons. There we go. Or Romulans. But you see what I'm saying. I mean, I don't mean to oversimplify it, but
I think he has a very, you know, cynical view of humanity in general, and his cynicism to me is such it perpetuates the fact that we can't evolve. He has us stuck. And I don't disagree with him saying that sexual urge, I believe that's a natural human thing. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Right.
It can be things wrong with that if you're violent. And he's saying, well, we are violent. And, you know, what you're saying,
we have the chance
to evolve in life via choices we make, via our will, via our morality, and all these things.
Right.
And sure, there's, you know, life is a constant evolution towards greater states of consciousness. And he wants to just say, the game's done. This is how it is. I know. Fuck you. He's haughty, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't say I have the answers, but, I mean, that's another thing. He's too certain of himself,
I think.
It is interesting, though, that the one interesting point I think he makes there is he places the will of the individual as opposed to the will of the community.
Right, right.
That's interesting.
That's interesting,
That the community, in order to perpetuate itself...
Mm-hmm.
has to tame its
rowdy
individuals.
Right, he has to internalize the role of the community within himself to watch over himself.
Oh, you said that too, yeah. He
yeah,
said that we have our own sort of minder in our head.
Right, right. And that can, I think...
He seems to not like civilization, does it?
I mean, he says some things, I think, yeah, okay. We do have civilization, quote-unquote, to allow communities to cohere and survive and prosper. But it, like you were saying, I mean, it's not necessarily in the best of situations mutually exclusive.
Right.
The good of the individual can parallel the good of the community.
Yeah.
The individual can flourish as the community. You know, it sounds utopian, and there's so much repression by governments today that it's easy to say, oh, fuck, it's all. But I think any time you'd be so bold as to lay out like a cosmic perspective, you really have to go deeper than that and think of the future. You know, I mean, he can. I mean, that was, you know,
that, yeah, those are
he saw World War One. He saw some dark times,
yeah.
Some dark, you know. So yeah, I mean, you'd say no, you know, we're just doomed as a species or whatever. But to adopt that position is defeatist, I think.
So that's Freud.
That's Freud.
And now we turn to Zan Marie Lloyd Taylor, if you.
Oh yeah, yeah. Mind.
Since we're doing cover hour.
Yeah, it's cover hour.
Is it the right book?
Yeah. Okay. All right. It's called Intersubjectivity.
Cosmic.
Yeah, I guess that.
Yeah.
Are you anyone? Noise, light, momentum, saturation, blocking space? Are you an apologetic swooping sound, blue and white, blinking, loping to the left? Are you sleek, clammy as a golem, sweet as a small burst of perspiration, dimpling like a logarithmic toddler, sitting like a log in an unlit fireplace, not even waiting? Do you touch sand, ice, concrete, clay? Do you hold a pen, a knife, a tray of soft food, a book about the gospel according to St. Paul? Do you cook your own meals or take a path through a blurring city to a neon diner, Starbucks, Dunkin' D's? Do you glance at a liquor store and move on, head high and away? Do you slip between dark lines in the pavement, beneath the elevated tracks, along subway lines, hanging your hand in a strap, grabbing politely for the pole with excuse me's? Are the poster ads not speaking to you? Are the other riders not looking your way? Are you there any more than a star, a train, a list of prepositions, on, over, above, a string of truths in a mirrored room, a moving line of anything, a circle brandishing itself? Are you 2 feet on the platform, wind, rain, earth, sun, traffic sound and lights? Are you no longer waiting, just tapping, tapping, lifting your heels, tapping?
Wow. Wow.
Yeah, I really like that.
Yeah,
that's
she's
fun.
Good.
Yeah.
He's good. He hits it. So, Jim, would you, since it's cover hour, would you like to...
Cover hour.
Yeah. Would you like to read something from Walden, which is in...
Oh,
it's just
sure.
It's just passages, so...
Sure.
So maybe you'll notice something in there that you recognize and like.
There's my hero. Jim Hugs. When I wrote the following pages, or rather the bulk of them, I lived alone in the woods, a mile from any neighbor, in a house which I had built myself. On the shore of Walden Pond in Concord, Massachusetts, and earned my living by the labor of my hands only. I lived there 2 years and 2 months. At present, I am a sojourner in civilized life again. I am Thoreau. I should not obtrude my affairs so much on the notice of my readers if very particular inquiries had not been made by my townsmen concerning my mode of life, which some would call impertinence, though they do not appear to me at all impertinent, but consider the circumstances very natural and pertinent. Some have asked what I got to eat, if I did not feel lonesome, if I was not afraid, and the like. Others have been curious to learn what portion of my income I devoted to charitable purposes, and some, who have large families, how many poor children I maintained. I therefore ask those of my readers who feel no particular interest and meet a part of me if I undertake to answer some of these questions in the book. In most books, the I of first person is omitted, and this will be retained. That, in respect to egotism, is the main difference. We commonly do not remember that it is, after all, always the first person that is speaking. I should not talk so much about myself if there were anybody else whom I knew as well. Unfortunately, I am confined to this theme by the narrowness of my experience. Moreover, I, on my side, require of every writer, first or last, a simple and sincere account of his own life, and not merely what he has heard of other men's lives. Some such account as he would send to his kindred from a distant land. For if he has lived sincerely, it must have been in a distant land to me. Perhaps these pages are more particularly addressed to poor students. As for the rest of my readers, They will accept such portions as apply to them. I trust that none will stretch the seams in putting on the coat, for it may do good service to him whom it fits. I see young men, my townsmen, whose misfortune it is to have inherited farms, houses, barns, cattle, and farming tools, for these are more easily acquired than got rid of. Better if they had been born in an open pasture and suckled by a wolf, that they might have seen with clearer eyes what field they were labeled to call in, what field they were called to labor in. Who made them serfs of the soil? Why should they eat their 60 acres when man is condemned to eat only his peck of dirt? Why should they begin digging their graves as soon as they are born? They have got to live a man's life, pushing all these things before them, and get on as well as they can. How many a poor mortal soul have I met well nigh crushed and smothered under its load, creeping down the road of life, pushing before it a barn 75 by 40, its Argan stables never cleansed, and 100 acres of land, tillage, mowing pasture, and woodlot. The portionless who struggle with no such unnecessary inherited encumbrances find it labor enough to subdue and cultivate a few cubic feet of flesh. But men labor under a mistake. The better part of the man is soon plowed into the soil for compost. By a seeming fate, commonly called necessity, they are employed, as it says in an old book, laying up measures which moth and rust will corrupt, thieves break through, and steal. It is a fool's life, as they will find when they get to the end of it, if not before. It is said that Deucalion and, I pronounce it, Pyrrha, created men by throwing stones over their heads behind them. I came to the woods to front the essentials of life, and know that when it came time for me to die, that at least I had tried to get the son of a bitch to live. that's a paraphrase. In the woods, that is. This is about staying warm. The necessities of life for man in this climate may accurately enough be distributed under the several heads of food, shelter, clothing, and fuel. For not till we have secured these, we're prepared to entertain the two true problems of life with freedom and a prospect of success. Man has invented not only houses, but clothes and good food, and possibly from the accidental discovery of the warmth of fire and the consequent use of it, at first a luxury, arose the present necessity to sit by it. We observe cats and dogs acquiring the second nature. By proper shelter and clothing, we legitimately retain our own inherited heat, internal heat. But with an excess of these, or fuel, that is, with an external heat greater than our own internal, may not cookery properly be said to begin. Darwin, the naturalist, says of the inhabitants of Terra del Fuego, that while his own party, who were well clothed and sitting close to a fire, were far too warm, these naked savages, who were farther off, were observed, to his great surprise, to be streaming with perspiration at undergoing such a roasting. So we are told the New Hollander goes naked with impunity, while the European shivers in his clothes. It is impossible to combine the hardiness of these savages with the intellectualness of a civilized man. According to Liebig, man's body is a stove and food a fuel, which heats up the internal combustion in the lungs. In cold weather, we eat more, in warm, less. The animal heat is a result of slow combustion, and the disease and death take place when this is too rapid, or for want of fuel, or from some defect in the drought. The fire goes out. The grand necessity, and I'll finish up here, the grand necessity then for our bodies is to keep warm, to keep the vital heat in us. What pains we accordingly take, not only with our food and clothing and shelter, but with our beds, with our night clothes, robbing the nests and breasts of bird to prepare this shelter within a shelter, as does mole his its bed of grass and leaves at the end of the burrow. The poor man is wont to complain that there is this is a cold world, and too cold, no less physical and social. We refer directly a great part of our ails. The summit, in some climates, makes possible to man a sort of Elysian life. Fuel, except to cook his food, is then unnecessary. The sun is his fire, and many of the fruits are sufficiently cooked by its rays. Our food generally is more various and more easily obtained, and clothing and shelter are wholly or half unnecessary. Most of the luxuries and many of the so-called comforts of life are not only indispensable, but positive hindrances to the elevation of mankind. The ancient philosophers, Chinese, Hindu, Persian, or Greek, were a class that which none has been poor in outward riches, none so rich inward. This is a delicious evening when the whole body in one sense and imbibes delight through every pore. I go and come with a strange liberty in nature, a part of herself. As I walk along the stony shore of the pond in my shirt sleeves, though it is cool as well as cloudy and windy, and I see nothing special to attract me, all the elements are unusually congenial to me. When I return to my house, I find that visitors have been there and left their cards, either a bunch of flowers, or a wreath of evergreen, or a name in pencil on a yellow walnut leaf, or a chip. They have come rarely to the woods to take some little piece of a forest into their hands to play with, by the way, which they leave either intentionally or accidentally.
Okay.
So this is by W.H. Auden.
And it was requested by Ralph.
Requested by Ralph.
Her telepathic station transmits thought waves, the second rate, the bored, the disappointed, and any of us, when tired or uneasy, are tuned to receive. So, though unlisted in atlas or phone book, her garden is easy to find. In no time one reaches the gate over which is written, large, make love, not war. Inside it is warm and still like a drowsy September day, though the leaves show no sign of turning. All around one notes the usual pinks and blues and reds, a shade overemphasized. The rose bushes have no thorns. An invisible orchestra plays the great masters. The technique is flawless, the rendering schmaltz. Of herself no sign, but just as the pilgrim is starting to wonder, have I been hoaxed by a myth? He feels her hand in his and hears her murmuring, at last. With me, Miss Top One, you shall learn the answers. What is conscience but a nattering fishwife? The tree of knowledge but the splintered mainmast of the ship of fools? Consent, you poor alien, to my arms where sequence is conquered, divisions abolished. Soon, soon, in the perfect orgasm, you shall, pet, be one with the all. She does not brutalize her victims. Beasts could bite or bolt. She simplifies them to flowers, sessile fatalists who don't mind and only can talk to themselves. All but a privileged few, the elite she guides to her secret citadel, the tower where a laugh is forbidden, and do harm as thou wilt is the law. Dear little not-so-innocents, beware of old grandmother spider. Rump her endearments. She's not quite as nice as she looks, nor you quite as tough as you think. May 1969.
Voices from Gaza. Prayers and morning birds. Music before dawn. Any morning, birds sing. Today's song, a relief. Bird tunes. Comfort my heart. Decision is born. What now, Peacock? False shrieks this morning? A dance of ego? Through dusty screen, clear sign of warning, birds before dawn. Again, Peacock and I, awakened by boom. Desert morning, crow signals another dry day. After heavy truck, crow feasts on furry carcass. Fallen stork on the side of the road refuses to die. Two voices wander the path, fly and sparrow. Some small bird sings with full heart this welcome day. Silence calls. Peacock calls back. All is well. And that's what I've got for you today. I hope you have a wonderful Jellicoe Literary Guild meeting. And please, people, record yourselves and talk about what's going on. I'm sorry you only know what I look like sitting in one special place. I'll just show you perhaps my puppets before we go. This is a puppet. Oh, there's the peacock. This is a puppet I made. This one is the male. It's the female I made during wartime when I was doing therapy for myself. This, and now I must say goodbye. See you soon. This poem is called Spiders. This year's nightmares are next year's sonnets. The words exist for people I don't know. I write them to alleviate the guilt of a population, people I've never met, people who never were. It's all right, I tell them, to regret your sins and sorrows. It's all right to lean into the corners of your couches and beg forgiveness. It's normal, I say, to look into the who's who in America and want to see your name. You are right to envy the names there and to start counting your failures. I know how it is. Not receiving prizes reeks of sweaty palms and botched attempts. Go ahead, think these things through. Our lives are fragrant with death, with the intrusion of aging, the reckoning of death's influence on our desires and dreams, the desperate tenderness in the face of certain oblivion. Still, each poem tries to right last year's wrongs. I must have been born to make something of my days. After all, how many missing husbands does it take to show the Black Widow what she really is? There are consolations. We vibrate with remembered lust. There is eroticism in every breath. We arrange chaos to avoid boredom. And what we leave behind disappears with rare tact. This second poem is called Unfit Ghazal. Stroke the arm, the hand, the fingers opening like silk. Fingers lost in hair, arms flexing, unflexing like silk. How young this makes us, how warm, pretty, smooth. Only age understands this change, this stirring of silk. We love the morning, the openness of ourselves to begin. There is strength in the sun, strength cool and holy as silk. The mirror touts me as younger than I am, maybe. My lover says I open to him as does a robe of blue silk. The stranger on the bus stared, and my throat ached for a drink, a whiskey and soda, smooth as silk. I challenge you to live this life as full as you can, without shame, without fear. Put on an armor of silk. Hear that sound? It's the world's heart pounding in your ears, praying for your attention, praying for food, offering silk. Along this dirt path where glass and lizards glow, a new berry bush is trying to prosper. Its leaves are silk. This last poem is called Gorilla Whining. This poem is pounding on the door of your perceptions, groveling at the knees of your conscience. I offer you the precarious kiss of reality, the work of the homeless to survive one more night, the limiting nature of nuclear incident, the criminality of our prejudices, the arrogance of our wealth. The monsters of commerce call to us, and we respond, choking on 1295 wine and caraway crackers. The whites of the world's eyes are blushing with exhaustion. Good people have calloused lips from sucking the blame out of the tall, frosted glasses held by congressmen and princes. We want to be dauntless in an era that begs us to forget, to ignore Iraq, Abu Ghraib, New Orleans. The fragile white palm of a politician's hand, forever urging the bloody adventures onward, waving as the world's warring stride off to meet, is the palm no one touches. We only imagine it, and still it pushes, directs, encourages, waves goodbye. Larry Leavis says that terror is a complete state of understanding. I get that. I agree with that. Politics is a meaningless famine. It gives us the necessary vocabulary to discuss our new myths. It is compensatory collateral that makes of us sheep children floating in nameless liquid, in clear glass jars on the shelves of fucking hell.
This doesn't really have as a refrain. Well, it does kind of. What is it? see. Ferry the river, ferry the sound, ferry me over to the high ground. There on the opposite shore, I am bound. So ferry the river. Ferry the river, ferry the tide, ferry me over where the water is wide. Destiny waits for me on that far side. Ferry the river, ferry me home. Ferry the shallows, ferry the deep. Ferry me safely, my conscience to keep. Carry me gently and rock me to sleep. Ferry the river, ferry me home. Ferry the channel, ferry the way, ferry my body and spirit to save. Deliver my soul from a watery grave. Ferry the river, ferry. Back from the island, back from the shore, back in the mainland to sorrow no more. Pat, promise me passage is all I ask for. Ferry the river, ferry me home. Ferry me over the white ocean foams. Ferry me back from wherever I roam. Come fetch me and hear me no longer alone. Over the river, come ferry me home.
Wow, that was very nice.
Wow.
I wondered about you doing that.
That was great, Jim.
Yeah, that was like
you were reading the music just by reading the words.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Reading the music by reading the words.
That was lovely. I'm going to make sure Barbara hears that. That was just lovely.
Yeah, I kind of varied it a bit as I went around, but
I'm sure she'll love that. That was Barbara's first contribution to the Jellicle Guild since December 2001.
She approves me putting it to music, and I had to play around with a couple little chords.
Oh, I'm sure she'll love it.
I just want to take a look at that.
Oh, you want to try this one?
I just had an idea for it.
Okay, give it a shot.
Well, I went to Lubbock, Texas, with one thing on my mind. The crossroads of musicians was what I sought to find. A particular intersection of two famous names at the corner of Bonnie Holly and Queens. Well, I drive my old Chevy down to Buddy Holly Avenue. I took my Fender guitar and my Nikon camera too. A picture of the street sign was my campaign for the corner of Bonnie Holly and Matt Davis. Matt Davis. Imagine my excitement, it couldn't be that hard. But where the place was supposed to be, there's still a railroad yard. You won't remember nothing but an old freight train at the corner of Bonnie Holly and Davis. Well, brother, that was a letdown. You face a sorry fact. The music's hollow ground. Now it was just a railroad track, cause there ain't no intersection I have to explain on how the corner body on the end of it is made. Well, I was so dejected, I got back in my car. I drove beneath the railroad tracks and out on Martha's shop. And in my rearview mirror, to this day I maintain that I found the corner of Bonnie Holly and Matt Davis Lane. Well, I had an inspiration. I thought, what the heck? So I drove my Chevy through the gates of Texas Tech. I swear I saw John Denver leaving on the jet plane from the corner of Bonnie Holly and Davis. I spotted the old meatloaf, whether you believe me or not. That surprise success, I said, let's call it a day. And at the corner of Bonnie Holly and McGregor's Lane. Now if you go down to Lubbock, there's music to be found. Who's Hancock, Clark, Terry Allen, or the Lubbock Underground? You may spy Joe Eli, but you won't see Natalie Maines. Name the corner of Bonnie Holly and McGinnis Lane. But if you want to catch a glimpse of a legendary star, marvelous old Lady Jennings and Jesse Guitar. Go wait for a little Benjamin at the corner of the body of the ends and McTavish Lane. It's a mythical location beneath the railroad tracks. Just plugging into your GPS and just keep coming back. You use your imagination and you won't have to search in vain for a corner of Body Holly and Beverly's Lane. For the corner of Body Holly and Beverly's Lane. For the corner of Body Holly and Beverly's
All right.
There you go.
Wonderful. So Joe sent me this poem out of the blue recently, and I will preface it simply by saying he said it is based upon a terrifying middle-of-the-night kind of dream vision that he had recently. And
I think I picked that out of that.
Yeah.
Okay, here we go. Last night, I was presented with the reality of God. In the 11th hour, I knew he was there. The world rocked and rattled in my ears. Everything screamed about me. My bed was boiling. I was forced to confront him, and he was far less forgiving than advertised. Something peeled my eyes open, a horror of white lights, the bones of my father. I made a plea for guidance and protection while my priests ran to their quarters, sealing themselves up like dolls in their chests. Who was to come but my neighbor Insanity? I listened to his song. I must keep mended the wall that divides us. That's the killer line.
Yeah, well, I thought God, that it was not for as forgiving as advertised.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good one. I like that a lot, too. But I love the way that ends.
Yeah, right.
Terry Tempest Williams is an author from Utah.
Mm-hmm.
She's Mormon, and I think she has some Indian blood in her too, which is kind of interesting. This book was originally published in 91, but it's called Refuge, An Unnatural History of Family and Place. She's a, like, wildlife,
like, yeah.
Bird, very much a bird person. She worked, or at least in this, at the time of this book, she was working at a bird conservatory that was being threatened by this gigantic, like, unprecedented flooding of the Great Salt Lake. So, but at the same time, she's dealing with this thing, which I'm going to read. The part I'm going to read will explain that. So, this is actually the epilogue, but, I belong to a clan of one-breasted women. My mother, my grandmothers, and six aunts have all had mastectomies. Seven are dead. The two who survive have just completed rounds of chemotherapy and radiation. I've had my own problems. Two biopsies for breast cancer and a small tumor between my ribs diagnosed as borderline malignancy. This is my family history. Most statistics tell us breast cancer is genetic, hereditary, with rising percentages attached to fatty diets, childlessness, or becoming pregnant after 30. What they don't say is living in Utah may be the greatest hazard of all. We are a Mormon family with roots in Utah since 1847. The word of wisdom in my family aligned us with good foods. No coffee, no tea, tobacco, or alcohol. For the most part, our women were finished having their babies by the time they were 30, and only one faced breast cancer prior to 1960. Traditionally, as a group of people, Mormons have a low rate of cancer. Is our family a cultural anomaly? The truth is, we didn't think about it. Those who did, usually the men, simply said bad genes. The women's attitude was stoic. Cancer was just part of life. On February 16, 1971, the eve of my mother's surgery, I accidentally picked up the telephone and overheard her ask my grandmother what she could expect. Diane, it is one of the most spiritual experiences you will ever encounter. I quietly put down the receiver. So I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. It is a well-known story in the Desert West, the day we bombed Utah, or more accurately, the years we bombed Utah. Above ground atomic testing in Nevada took place from January 27, 1951 through July 11, 1962. Not only were the winds blowing north, covering, quote, low-use segments of the population, unquote, with fallout and leaving sheep dead in their tracks, but the climate was just right. The United States of the 1950s was red, white, and blue. The Korean War was raging. McCarthyism was rampant. Ike was it, and the Cold War was hot. If you were against nuclear testing, you were for a communist regime. Much has been written about this American nuclear tragedy. Public health was secondary to national security. The Atomic Energy Commissioner, Thomas Murray, said, "Gentlemen, we must not let anything interfere with this series of tests. Nothing." Again and again, the American public was told by its government, in spite of burns, blisters, and nausea, quote, "It has been found that the tests may be conducted with adequate assurance of safety under conditions prevailing at the bombing reservations," unquote. Assuaging public fears was simply a matter of public relations. "Your best action," an Atomic Energy Commission booklet read, "is not to be worried about fallout." A news release typical of the time stated, "We find no basis for concluding that harm to any individual has resulted from radioactive fallout." In Mormon culture, authority is respected, obedience is revered, and independent thinking is not. I was taught as a young girl not to make waves or rock the boat. "Just let it go," my mother would say. "You know how you feel. That's all that counts." For many years, I have done just that. Listened, observed, and quietly formed my own opinions in a culture that rarely asks questions because it has all the answers. But one by one, I have watched the women in my family die common, heroic deaths. We sat in waiting rooms hoping for good news, but always expecting and receiving the bad. I cared for them, bathed their scarred bodies, and kept their secrets. I watched beautiful women become bald as cytoxin, cisplatin, and dryamycin were injected into their veins. I held their foreheads as they vomited green-black bile, and I shot them with morphine when the pain became inhuman. In the end, I witnessed their last peaceful breaths, becoming a midwife to the rebirth of their souls. The price of obedience has become too high. The fear and inability to question authority that ultimately killed rural communities in Utah during atmospheric testing of atomic weapons is the same fear I saw in my mother's body. Sheep, dead sheep. The evidence is buried. I cannot prove that my mother, Diane Dixon Tempest, or my grandmothers, Letty Romney Dixon and Catherine Blackett Tempest, along with my aunts, developed cancer from nuclear fallout in Utah, but I can't prove that they didn't. I crossed the line at the Nevada test site and was arrested with 9 other Utahans for trespassing on military lands. They are still conducting nuclear tests in the desert. Ours was an act of civil disobedience, but as I walked toward the town of Mercury, it was more than a gesture of peace. It was a gesture on behalf of the clan of one-breasted women. As one officer cinched the handcuffs around my wrists, another frisked my body. She found a pen and a pad of paper tucked inside my left boot. "And these?" she asked sternly. "Weapons," I replied. Our eyes met. I smiled. She pulled the leg of my trousers back over my boot. "Step forward, please," she said as she took my arm. We were booked under an afternoon sun and bused to Tonopah, Nevada. It was a 2-hour ride. This was familiar country. The Joshua trees standing their ground had been named by my ancestors who believed they looked like prophets pointing west to the promised land. These were the same trees that bloomed each spring, flowers appearing like white flames in the Mojave, and I recall the full moon in May when Mother and I had walked among them, fleshing out mourning doves and owls. The bus stopped short of town. We were released. The officials thought it was a cruel joke to leave us stranded in the middle of the desert with no way to get home. What they didn't realize was that we were home, soul-centered and strong, women who recognized the sweet smell of sage as fuel for our spirits.
Mm-hmm. What year was that written, did you say?
78? Well, it was written in 91.
Wow.
Yeah, I've heard of that. I mean, not the fact and the way they put it, the tribe of one Western woman, which is very apt, I suppose, because it affected women in that way. But I've heard about this.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, yeah, about the testing and the way, and at the time, they just did a complete cover-up. Yeah. I mean, total cover-up.
It wasn't even covered up. It was just as part of the deal. I mean, the people who are living there.
So. My folks, they got married in 53. They told me, you know, about that time. And there was just, well, McCarthyism. I read about McCarthy. And it was true. And you didn't question the government. You did not question them. I mean, if you did, you did it at home. You didn't disagree with the government, period. Or you were labeled a communist.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing.
I wonder if lawsuits have occurred.
She mentioned, like, some of the really early ones, even in the...
Yeah.
Right after. I just skipped that part for time's sake. But I wanted to actually close with her... she starts with a poem called Wild Geese by Mary Oliver. And everybody at the school I went to, like, had this poem memorized, it's very pretty. It's called Wild Geese. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese high in the clean blue air are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over announcing your place in the family of things.
That is a lovely poem. I know that poem. Yeah.
I think she wrote this book as, I think her mom had just died, and she was, as she said, struggling with her own little dying problems, and the flood was like the bird migratory, I forget what it is, refuge, was her sanctuary, and it was under 8 feet of water for most of the time she was dealing with this, and so it's like her, everything constant in her life was gone.
Upon summer's commence, I begin these lines, and they are pretty much the last ones for this issue of the Cenacle. Mold this way and that, what they should address, and at least a couple of dead ends have come to this. It's a year soon, I've been living back in Boston, in New England, and this topic convinces me it's best of all. I came from Connecticut and lived there until 1992, when nearly 30 years of age, I moved to Boston to go to graduate school at Northeastern University, master's in English. A lot of loans to float the deal. In truth, I'd been trying to figure my way up here since 1983, when I took a college field trip here, just a day. It was enough. I think of Boston as the city itself and the smaller cities and towns that surround it, Cambridge, Brookline, Malden, Arlington, and so on, a sort of equivalent of the boroughs of New York City. I arrived, went to school, worked, went to more school at Emerson College, 10 years passed. Then I left in 2002, lived out west in Seattle and Portland for a year, then back to Connecticut to lick some wounds, then back to Seattle and Portland for 7 years, returned to Boston in early July 2010, and so. I was tired of Boston in 2002, as much as I'd loved it for so long. I was laid off, jobless, most of my local longtime friends were distant in one way or another, and worse, I'd fallen in love with a girl on the West Coast. The signs I chose to heed pointed me out there. I left to chase the hippie dream on the left coast. Through most of 2002, Scripter Press existed only online and at the Burning Man Arts Festival in Nevada. I wrote fiction and poetry as ever, but aside from the Electro Lounge website, it wasn't to be found anywhere. The Cenacle's gap in issues was 18 months, from number 46, June 2001, to number 47, December 2002. Eventually, I found a quite preferable girl and more steady days in the Pacific Northwest. For a long while, I thought I'd settled out there, 2003 to 2010. That's a long time. I came back here because the burnt-out feelings that led me away ground to dust and blew away. The dream of the West came and went too. I think home, like love and commitment, is a passing and passing, a shifting in place and form over time. Where I'd walked around this metropolis 9 years ago thinking, going, going, I now think returning, staying. The year past has been a struggle among the pleasures. As of this writing, I have recently gotten work, took the year to do it, and am hopeful of a steadier stretch for a while. So maybe moving from returning to staying at last. There have been moments that have confirmed anew and anew the rightness of return. They are of many kinds, bringing the Jellicoe Literary Guild back to its origins in New England, the change of Scripter Press's name to Scripter Press New England, that these notes are again called notes from New England. More, seeing the delightful obscure road movie Scarecrow at the well-hidden Harvard Film Archive, finding it from years-old memory, and afterward listening to its director, Jerry Schatzberg, speak proudly of his 38-year-old film. Seeing the spectacular exhibition Dale Chihuly through the Looking Glass exhibition at the Museum of Fine Arts, no less to mention again being near Renoir's Dance at Bougival and the MFA's room full of Impressionist paintings, or the New Art of America's wing. Places. The exotic Forest Hill Cemetery in Jamaica Plain with its wonderful 19th century aesthetic view of burying the dead as an art form. Winter Island up in Salem, its grass ruins of an old fort. Ogunquit on the southern Maine coast, its plentiful magic in wintertime. The rocky little town of Rockport on the north shore, its ye oldie feeling escaped after a time to the granite pier's endless oceanside song. The delights of finding new places to write, the friendly 24/7 gourmet market in Cambridge, the beautifully redesigned Marriott Hotel Lounge at Copley Place in Boston, the large windowed and lovely Starbucks in Harvard Square, and the favorite old places like Hoary Old Diesel Cafe in Somerville and the Courtyard and Cafe of this very Aubin Pan nearby that Harvard Square Starbucks. I see the area with a multiple vision of what is here now, what was here when I lived here 1992 to 2002, and what I can recall from my visits up from Connecticut from 1983 to 1992. I see back and forth. There is mostly comfort, even delight. I never had this vision in Seattle or Portland. Others around me had it, and I envied them. I was living in somebody else's book out there, no matter how hard I tried. I conclude here with why I chose to write on this topic. When I left here in 2002, I didn't think I'd return. Then over the years, I'd joked that someday I'd be an old man at this Aubin Pan Cafe courtyard. Now I sit here. But this too. I left here in 2002 jobless, lonely, tired, bent on chasing a fruitless dream. For years, I didn't even visit. I didn't want to confront that departure or its aftermath. For a year now, I've been confronting it, how returning feels, how time passes, how nothing goes away and nothing returns. Being jobless here, years later, but the same dark rage over it, not alone this time, but still, shut out from the better aspects of daily human traffic. Even now employed, the wounds of recent years remain, the lack of trust that a job will remain, that a bean counter won't nod and cross out my name. Real, real, and time to smooth it out from live rage to remembered. For all the mixtures of joys and sadnesses through my years-long relation with Boston, with New England, I can only say this. I don't wish to be anywhere else. Through my own worst hours and idiocies, I know this is true. It is simply what my brother Rick Amante calls gratefulness. Fears, yes, and regrets, sure, but hungers for new connections and renewed old ones, new plans to know more and remember better and cultivate hope. It's not that I've earned my return here. It's that having returned, I earn my place here every day, every hour, sometimes better, sometimes worse. Gratefulness, privilege, the wish to show my worth now to all those wandering ears, that I remember them, and to the many times to come, better if I make them so.
Yeah, okay, it's called The Tower. There's a little bit of fanatic in everyone. So when a bearded man as destroyer, elite with vengeance, is killed by the hand of man, that hand kills a little bit of everyone. It kills Glenn Beck, it slays Laura Ingraham and Ann Coulter in the same green room. It slaughters Rush Limbaugh and terminates the cackling jubilation of Jon Stewart, rejoicing in the last moments and two bullets. Colbert mocking the remains of his brains as though a brain is a weapon to be disarmed. It kills whatever bit of us would kill another for opinion, or a promise of action or mass murder. It destroys the line between idea and thought, between idea and action, thought and the agony of enacting a plan that kills thousands. We are not separate. Can we install evil in one person and leave it there? It bleeds. It seeds the air like pollen. When one light is struck out, for a moment, illumination brightens all horizons. We are purged through our own projection, our outpouring of hunger into the diminishment of another. Then it starts again. But for a while, it is not grounded. It spins and spurts bile like an offshore oil rig on a ride. It spills. And we will regret and we will miss that depiction of a hidden villain. No dull, angry aristocrat, but an exotic demon in robes, bigger, better than our practiced images, the evils of the Third Reich, a funny man with bad mustache like Charlie Chaplin, a screamer, a shame-ridden boy-man mongrel grabbing for salvation through blood purification, a small, mean man whose power ate away what he touched, who powered a machine malfunctioning in lockstep. This is something else, a cold anger, a foreign xenophobic presence. Maybe the man Gene Dixon predicted as the Antichrist. If you kill the Antichrist, what will resurrect? After 3 days underwater, what fish will swim? What rock will slip away and release the demons flushed with poison oil and emerging strengthened without dullness and anger, with the pure power that infests us again? Because if you could crucify the Antichrist, the rebound, the dense reflection cancels our salvation, our little bit of hope, our anger and love. He brings it back into us. That we can see now, how he could have done it, because we did it, from fear, hatred, rubble, poison in the air, burned dust, the tower.